You're listening to another episode of the Young Investors Podcast, so sit back and relax as myself, Brandon, and my buddy Hamish discuss the latest in the world of finance and stock market investing. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing and you need some help, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with all that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast. All right, everyone, welcome back. Hamish, how you doing?
Yeah, going well. Going well.
Going well. Did you watch the cricket final during the week?
No, I didn't. I don't watch too much cricket, really.
You're not a cricket person?
No, not really. I watched the Formula One over the weekend.
That was did you?
Yeah, it was a good race. Did you watch that?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. That was actually a very close race. Lewis Hamilton got over the line in the end, but that was tense for the middle part of that race.
Yeah, unbelievable what he did. The 25 places made up.
Yeah, incredible. There was lots of drama that week. That's right, because Lewis Hamilton got in trouble for the rear wing opening issue, and Max Verstappen got in trouble for the touching his car. Look, imagine that. For those that don't know, so once these race cars are in their race setup, you're not allowed to make any changes to them. It's called parc fermé setup. And Max Verstappen gets out of his Formula One car and he walks over to Lewis Hamilton's car and he starts messing around with the rear wing, like putting his hands on it and wiggling it around and stuff like that. And which is totally not allowed. He shouldn't have done that because they're in parc fermé. Well, he shouldn't have been touching another competitor's car, period. But the fine that he got for doing so, I think, was 50,000 euros.
Yeah.
Awesome. Oh, ouch.
Yeah.
Imagine touching someone's car, getting fined 50 grand or 50,000 euros for it.
Oh. Yeah. And then Hamilton, at the end of the race, he took his seatbelt off to hold up the Brazilian flag and he got a 9,000 euro fine for taking his seatbelt off while he was still on the track.
Oh my God.
That's some driving offense, 9,000 pounds or 9,000 euros. So.
Wow. Intense.
Yeah.
It's big. Everything with Formula One is just big money, isn't it?
It's crazy.
It's insane. It's big money.
I'm invested now. I'm so invested.
Oh, are you? That's good. Get around it. Yeah. I want to do a video on Drive to Survive because that Netflix show has actually revived Formula One.
Oh, yeah.
It's just a crazy tale of how Netflix, publicly traded company, creates a show for Formula One, which forms part of another publicly traded company. And it's just it's just a match made in heaven. And Netflix has ended up helping this company out so much because it's just brought back so much viewership to the sport. It's just phenomenal. I can't remember who the parent company of Formula One is.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I can't remember. Formula One owned by Liberty Media.
Right.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah.
So Liberty shareholders will be very happy that Netflix has made Drive to Survive. It's a really good show if you haven't seen it, and it's very good, very, very good show. You should definitely check it out.
All right.
Anyway.
we've actually got a lot to talk about, so we should probably dive straight into it after we get to our sponsor segment. But we've got a little bit of an update on Rivian. I just had to share just a quick update, on inflation that we should have got to last week, but for some reason we didn't. So, little update on inflation. And then we'll jump into talking about some of the big 13F filings. So, 13F filings are, of course, that quarterly filing that big institutional investors need to make and disclose their stock market investments. So we get to take a look at Monish, what he's been doing, Warren Buffett, and Michael Borry will be talking about today. So a lot to get through. We'll do our best to kind of jam pack today's episode. I think we'll just get straight into it. So today's episode is sponsored by ShareSite, which is an application you can use to track the performance of your stock portfolio. Basically allow you to track all of the different types of gains. So capital gains, dividends. If you have dividend reinvestment plans, it will do all of those calculations for you. Currency gains, if you're buying shares internationally or you hold foreign currencies. And then you can also use it for when it comes to tax time. So ShareSite generates up to 10 different reports that can be used at tax time to work out things such as capital gains, dividend income, and more. And at the moment, you can try ShareSite for free by heading over to ShareSite.com/young investors. That's site spelled S-I-G-H-T, ShareSite.com/young investors. So use that link, sign up to a free plan and track up to 10 holdings for as long as you want. There's a free plan. It's not a free trial. Just use it for as long as you want. Or you can also use that link to sign up to a pay plan for more features, more reporting, and you can get 4 months off a yearly subscription if you use our link. So go check it out if you're interested. It's a great service. Yeah. And thanks to everyone who has used that link when signing up and is supporting the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. If you want to sign up, just go for it. If you're paying for it, you just essentially what you're doing is you're using it for, well, yes, portfolio tracking, but I think most people are just using it for keeping track of their tax records, because it's very, very good at doing that, because it tracks absolutely everything. It knows like franked dividends. It knows, you know, your dividend income, your capital gains, capital loss. It knows everything. So it is very handy. You just print out their reports, and it'll tell you, like, if you want to do your tax return yourself, it'll say like all of the different lines of your tax return. This is what you put in here. This is what you put in there. But to be honest, what I do is I just print it out and I just send it over to my accountant. And he's like, yeah, gee, thank you very much.
Done.
And he just chucks it all. Yeah. It's so simple. So yeah, definitely. If you're interested, then check them out. But can we get into this Rivian stuff? So yeah. Up until now, so the IPO actually has happened now.
Yes,
we've been talking about it for a while. They wanted an $80 billion IPO, $80 billion valuation. I think what they were trying to raise like between $10 and $13 billion from the IPO, but they wanted an $80 billion valuation. Then that dropped back to like $50 billion, and then it went back up to $70 something billion. And I think that's last week we were talking about how they wanted to lock that in. That's what they were going for. And oh my gosh, what the hell has happened since this thing has IPO'd? This is just, I mean, it's a sign of the times, isn't it? It's crazy.
It really seemed like they were unsure what they were going to be able to get out of this IPO. Yeah. Because I think, I mean, all of the different prices that they suggested, I think, I mean, in my view at least, were insane. I mean, you're talking about multiple billions, tens of billions of dollars in value for a business that I think produced or delivered 156 vehicles so far. So it's it's basically a pre-revenue business that was getting a valuation of approximately $50 billion. So it went public at what we spoke about last week, which was the $78 per share, giving it a valuation of about $70 to $80 billion. And they ended up raising $12 billion on the listing. So, very successful from them. I think prior to that, their biggest investor was Amazon, who owns 22% of the business, and they bought essentially 22% of the business for $1.3 billion. So,
oh my god,
to get another 12 out of this raising is incredibly good for the business. That's a lot of money that they now have access to fund their operations. But that wasn't even the craziest part of what happened. What happened next was what was crazy. So that it started at $78 on the day and it shot all the way up to $100 by the end of the day, giving it a market cap of over $100 billion, which is just...
Wow.
Which is just, it really is just something else, right? It's, it made it the second most valuable automaker in the United States after Tesla, even higher than Ford, which I think has about a $70 billion valuation. And you know, that's a company that produces 4 million vehicles a year and 100 plus billion in revenue. So
for
this business to literally have a market cap, well, I mean, and up till yesterday, it went up to $172 per share. So it was well over double the value of Ford, which is actually, you know, producing cars.
Yeah, that's correct. That's the thing, isn't it? Like, I probably have the opinion that Ford's a pretty crappy company overall, and it's probably not, you know, it's probably doesn't deserve to have an enormously high market cap. But even still, just like if you compare and contrast the two different companies, it's like Ford has all of that infrastructure built. They have the logistics sorted. They have the processes and the employees sorted. They've got their suppliers sorted. They've got everything. It's a complete machine. It's an oiled machine, and it's running and it's producing. How many did you say? 4.2
million last year.
4.2 million vehicles.
Yeah.
you know, they've got the factories, they're doing it. And then you look at their market cap and then you flick over to Rivian and you're like, so this company, Rivian, has a higher market cap. So the investors are saying that it's worth more than Ford. And like, they've got really, in the grand scheme of things, like almost nothing so far. I know that's going to change and they're going to grow into that. Well, maybe it might take a long time, but they'll grow into some sort of valuation, you know. But it's just crazy seeing that, okay, investors are saying we're willing to pay more for this company than Ford.
Yeah.
It blows my mind.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That is, it's just complete insanity because I agree with you. Obviously, I think maybe Ford's, you know, days are numbered here in the auto industry, maybe. But I mean, they're still a business that is, what, a 100-year-old automaker with a huge brand behind it, huge infrastructure, as you mentioned. So there is value there, right? Like maybe it's not, you know, the value of a business that can grow it 30% per year, like some of these growth businesses will. But there's, you know, there's substantial value there. Whereas you look at something like Rivian, which is literally a moonshot. And it's kind of crazy. I made a video that came out a couple of days ago, well, now a few days ago when this is released. And I just did a comparison to the Rivian IPO to Yahoo of 2000, because Yahoo was like the kind of the darling of the dot-com bubble, where the business had about $1 million in revenue when it IPO'd. Was not profitable. Right. It IPO'd at about $1 billion valuation, and then in 2 years surged to $100 billion in valuation. And then, you know, a decade later, it was sold for $4 billion. So it's 97% of its value was wiped out. And I just thought it was such a good comparison of two businesses that basically are pre-revenue and reach $100 billion market cap, and how insane that is.
Yeah.
It really is just complete insanity. Like, there's no justification in my view for that. I don't know. I just think it's just, I don't know. I don't really know what to think. It's just ridiculous. It's completely insane. And the stock today fell for the first time since IPO. Every day was just up, up, up. Today it fell about 15% back to $150 per share. So now it has a market cap of just $125 billion. So
only.
I mean, in all seriousness, I mean, I said in my video, if this stock dropped 99.9% and went to like $100 million of market cap, it would probably still be overvalued in my view.
Yeah. It's bonkers. Did you see Michael Burry kind of weighed in on this?
No, I didn't actually.
Oh, he was just saying, he just tweeted like, I'm looking at the tweet here. It says, more speculation than the 1920s, more overvaluation than the 1990s, more geopolitical and economic strife than the 1970s. And he's like linked an article along with that tweet where it's just like, it's basically an article of how ridiculous the Rivian IPO is.
Yeah.
So he's clearly, thinking along the same kind of mindset that we are as well.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't know what to think anymore because there's just always some ridiculous thing going on over the past couple of years. It's just been, I mean, we had a bit of a break through the pandemic. Things just like, obviously the pandemic was kind of devastating, but it kind of brought the stock market, it kind of shook the stock market back to reality for like a couple months there. Like it was like people like, whoa, okay, this market doesn't just go up in a straight line. Like there's, you know, there's problems here. And then since then, it's just been, I mean, valuations are far higher than they were even in 2019 when people were screaming that things were overvalued. So, it's just an insane market. I mean, the same thing is true for the inflation numbers coming out. It's just, there's just a constant flow of things that I'm just perplexed by in this market.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of inflation.
Yeah. we were supposed to talk about this last week because this was 8 days ago now, this news. So, I guess we could have caught it last week, but we missed it. But the monthly CPI, consumer price index data that tracks inflation, came out a week ago. It was not pretty. October CPI data increased 6.2% over the past 12 months. Which is the highest that it's increased in 30 years. So,
wow.
We're still going up, 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 up.
Yeah, true, actually, because there was a couple months ago, it was like 5.3 or 5.2.
Yeah.
So, yeah, now we're up to 6.2.
Yeah, and it kind of, if you look at the chart from, I can't remember what the place is where the data comes from, but if you just Google search the consumer price data in the United States, and you look at the chart, it's been going up for, you know, the past 6 months or so. And then there was kind of a flat period where it just hovered around 5.5% for a couple of months, and everybody was screaming, "Oh, it's peaked. It's transitory. Look, we've reached a nice plateau here, and down comes inflation, and we're going to get back into that 2-3% range that everybody wants." And then, yeah, I mean, this month it just shot up massively. I mean, on a month over month basis, this is kind of crazy. Inflation was 0.9%. Over 30 days, which is insane, right? That's what we want to happen over over a third of a year is ideally, or even a half of a year.
6 months.
Yeah, 6 months. Much. We would want about 1%, and we got that in the last 30 days, which is crazy. On an annualized basis, not that, you know, it's going to be 0.9% every month for the next year, but just to put that in perspective, on an annualized basis, if that monthly inflation continues for a year, that's 11% annual inflation, which is really high.
That's crazy, crazy, crazy. I mean, I'm not really an expert, but I kind of look at this and I'm like, how much pressure would Jerome Powell and the Fed be under to raise rates now?
Yeah.
I feel like-
I
feel like they've like for the past little while, they've been saying, no, we'll think about raising rates in 2024. And now they've said, maybe 2023. I feel now they're going to be saying, we'll raise them next year. And then it might be, we're going to raise them in January of next year.
I'm certainly no expert either. And I'm not claiming to know that, you know, claiming to say that I knew this was going to happen or anything is going to happen. But I just find it amazing that the Fed continues to come out and say that they know what inflation is going to do. I mean, like, it's been a long time now that we've had out of the Fed and just generally that transitory, that inflation, you know, is going to peak or has peaked, right? I mean, it was supposed to peak. I don't know if people remember this, but it was supposed to peak between March and June of this year, because that was where the worst comparison was.
True.
For a 12-month period, right? We had in March to June this year, we would be comparing inflation from this year to the depths of the pandemic where there was deflation.
Yeah.
So even that was, I think, about 4% inflation. We're at 6 now, and we don't have comparisons to the deflationary period anymore. So that's true factors that lean on the inflationary side. And it's just amazing to me that people continue to claim to know what's going to happen with the inflation.
Yeah.
And it's also amazing to me that the Fed is still doing quantitative easing, that they're still printing money and buying bonds in this kind of inflationary environment. But what do I know? I'm just a guy from Melbourne who...
We're just plebs. I'm plebs on the internet running our little YouTube channels.
But I just want to hear what the next thing is out of the Fed. I'm very curious to see what they say.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, they've been saying that it's going to peak and that it's transitory for a long time now.
I just wonder, that I'm sure that they would have had this discussion. Maybe it's not been kind of publicly reported on because they don't want to kind of have people cling on to any sort of numbers. But they must have discussed like different scenarios. Mm. So, what happens if... this? What happens if that? And they must have a number where if inflation spiked to this number, then they have agreed that they will raise rates. And I just wonder, like, obviously I don't know, but I just wonder what that number is. How willing are they to let inflation kind of keep going? Because they started out by saying, look, we want to see it around 2% per year inflation. And then they kind of, inflation went higher, and then they changed the tune to, oh, look, you know, it's been lower than 2% for a long time. So we're going to let it run so it catches up to a long-term rate of 2%. Mm. And I wonder now if it starts going 6%, 7%, 8%, 10% inflation, what's the number where they go, you know what? I think this is it.
Yeah.
And they come in and they raise rates and they try and put the clamps on, because they've also got past examples that they can look back and learn from, I guess. Because I remember I did a video about it once, I think, where in the 1970s, the US experienced massive inflation. And one of the problems that they had is that they let inflation go. And then after inflation had gone, then they tried to stop it. And the thing that they should have learned from that is that it's better to step in and stop inflation before it happens than let it run and then try and stop it.
Yeah.
And so I just wonder what that number is where they do actually step in and make a change.
Yeah, I mean, they're terrified of doing that because they know the market's going to collapse as soon as they do that.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, if they raise rates it's not going to happen, but like if they raised rates, for example, like this year, if they said, yeah, next month, actually things are too hot, we have to raise rates, the market would collapse. There's zero doubt in my mind. So they're trying to be very, very careful about it, obviously. But I mean, talk on that 2-3% range in which we are happy that inflation is in. That's where we want to see inflation. It's been above that range for 7 months now. So in my mind, it's not necessarily, well, part of it is what number does it get to before you're like, whoa, 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 inflation is way too high. But the other thing is we're already too high. So it's a matter of how long are we happy for it to be at 6% or 5%, right?
Yeah, it's
like,
a good point.
We're not happy for it to be at 5% for the next 10 years. That's too high. Or even the next 5 years. So what is it? Is it 12 months? If we're still here in 5 months' time, by the middle of next year, then do we start to raise rates and push it down? Or is it 24 months? Or is it 3 years? And I think this is the problem, is they're very reluctant to raise rates because they know it's going to hurt the market and that hurts people's wealth and it hurts the economy. They don't want to do that. They want inflation to fix itself. So they're going to lean on the side of hoping that inflation fixes itself, and then we'll see what happens. Either it will or it won't, and inflation will be a lot higher than it is now before they fix it, I would expect. So,
yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, I don't know.
Who knows? That's the thing. Who knows? It's out of our hands. It's in the hands of how many people sit on that board? Is it like 12 or something? 12 or 13 people? It's in the hands of them.
Hands of the gods.
Yeah, pretty much. Jerome Powell. There you go. There's a nice little ego boost, Jerome Powell. Getting called a god.
Oh, boy.
All right.
I think we should talk about some 13F filings.
All right.
We've got a couple to talk about. Mate, do you want to take us through? Where do you want to start? You take us through one.
I want to start with Monish Pabrai.
Mm.
I would normally start with Warren Buffett, but to be honest, Warren Buffett's 13F was less exciting this time around. So Monish Pabrai, the big news out of his 13F is that he has been selling Alibaba. And yeah, you've probably seen a few videos on YouTube over the past week or so, one from myself as well, about this topic. And this is confusing because... this is a stock that was bought by Charlie Munger in Q1, bought by Monish Pabrai in Q1, Guy Spear Q2, I think, in Q3. So that this 13F period that we're looking at now, Charlie Munger added 82% to his Alibaba position, and so we're all sitting here, just absolutely betting our lives that, you know, Monish Pabrai is definitely buying more Alibaba. Mm. It's like, we're not even considering the idea that he's not buying Alibaba. Yeah. It's like, well, of course, it's going to be so obvious that 13F is going to come out and Monish is going to have added like 100% to his Alibaba position. And then it comes out and it shows that he has sold 78% of his Alibaba position, which is kind of crazy and extremely unexpected.
It's almost the opposite of what you would expect. It was basically the opposite of what Munger did. So,
exactly. Yeah. And Monish Pabrai is known as the shameless cloner. You know, he clones the best investors. And, you know, so I was definitely, as soon as that Munger 13F came out, I was like, yeah, for sure. He's definitely cloning him. He's going to buy more. But nope. He sold 78% of his holdings, and yeah, at first this caught us all off guard. We just had no idea what was going on. But there's actually been some clues here and there over the past week or so, really, that kind of helps us have a pretty good guess at why he sold out of this position. And it's not actually as sinister as what it looks like at face value. So, first of all, I just wanted to go through the five different reasons. I've made a video about this, so I'll try and keep this a little bit more succinct. But there's kind of five hypotheses why he might have sold. The first is that he sold the Barber shares to buy the Hong Kong listed Alibaba, 9988, instead. And people are talking about that because there's the slight delisting risk in the US if they can't sort out the auditing laws through the Holding Foreign Companies Accountable Act, geez, that's a mouthful, which they need to sort out in the next couple of years. At the moment, they need foreign companies listed in the US to be audited by
an American auditor.
Yeah, an auditor that's approved by the Board of American Auditors or something like boring. And the Chinese government basically says, no, we're not allowing that for Chinese companies.
Yeah.
So, there's something that needs to be worked out. But I think this is less of an issue anyway, because at the end of the day, if you hold the Hong Kong stock, if you hold the Frankfurt stock, if you hold the New York Stock Exchange stock, then even if Barber gets delisted, you're not going to sidestep the share price declines from that delisting. I mean, you're still holding shares in the VIE, which is in the Cayman Islands, which is just on three different exchanges. So, you're still going to cop it either way. So, I don't think this is going to be what Monish is doing. Mm-hmm. There's another idea that there might have been a massive redemption in the fund. So, someone's decided that they want to take their money out of the fund. And, you know, if Monish was all in, then I guess he would have to sell down some of his positions to be able to meet that redemption. I think that's less likely, to be honest. There's also the risk of Alibaba, just the risks associated became a little bit too much for him. We've seen continued, CCP kind of crackdowns on tech and monopolistic practices and that sort of stuff. So maybe he's decided that, nah, enough's enough. Again, I think this is less likely because, I mean, he knew that the CCP was a factor before he went into this investment. Like, there's no way that Monish didn't do his DD on the Chinese Communist Party before he bought Alibaba. So, I feel like him having a sudden change of heart in that aspect is probably not really the reason behind it.
I feel like that's less likely, yeah. There's nothing that's kind of been a major shift as far as I can see in that respect with Alibaba since he invested in the business. Very different, I think, to, say, Warren Buffett when he invested in the airlines and then the pandemic hit. That's a dramatic shift in his opinion about those businesses long-term. So then, that required him to sell those businesses. But nothing like that, I think, is, as far as I'm aware, has happened
with Alibaba. Not really.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So, that's the third kind of reason. I'm kind of doing these in order of what I think is more likely. So, those first three I don't think are very likely. These last two I think have more weight behind them. So, there's also a hypothesis that because it's nearing the end of the American tax year, that he might have been locking in a loss to offset the tax he has to pay on capital gains. I was looking in just very briefly, looked at the laws around, they call it wash sales, which is essentially just trying to take advantage of those capital gains tax laws and capital loss laws. And apparently, it's legal in the US as long as there's a 30-day period between when you sell and when you buy again.
Yeah.
So, if he's run into a massive profit this year, then it's coming towards the end of the tax year, and he loves Alibaba, but he also sees that he's down like 20 or 30% from when he originally bought in, maybe just sold to then lock in a loss, which he'll then buy back into in more than 30 days from now. So there's something there, potentially, but I think way more like, I definitely put a lot more weight into this theory, is that he's actually decided he would prefer to own Tencent than Alibaba. And this is very interesting because he could have, bought Tencent in Hong Kong and it wouldn't have shown up in the 13F. So, that makes sense because we haven't seen any hint that he's bought Tencent in the 13S. We've just seen, it just looks as though he sold Alibaba. But honestly, because he's still saying he loves Alibaba's business. So, I feel like if for him to sell that position, he's had to have found something better, substantially better, that he says, you know what? I'm happy to lock in a 30% loss. in order to be able to buy the shares of this company at this price. And I think that is Tencent. Mm. Reason being that reason why I think he's so bullish on Tencent is that like a week ago, he released a 2-hour video, I think. But in the first half of the video is just like a monologue of how good Tencent's business is.
He released a 2-hour video that's titled, "I'm buying Tencent." And this is why I think maybe, you know. It'd be pretty funny if he just did that, like, "Stocks I'm buying."
That'd be so funny. Or it's just like his face and the, like mouth open, hands on face, and it's like the title is "All in Tencent stock."
Yeah, that'd be such a troll if he did that. That would be the best. That'd be so good if he just did a Q&A and just that would make my day if he just titled it like "Stocks I'm Buying October" or something like that. just a troll.
Oh gosh, that would honestly be hilarious. That would be great. So, yeah, anyway, getting back to it. So, yeah, I think he's bought Tencent, but I don't actually think he's bought Tencent. I think he's been buying a company called Prosus. Have you heard about this, Hamish?
I've heard a little bit about it, but...
A little bit, okay.
Yeah, walk me through it.
Well, I actually have to give a lot of credit to Investing with Tom because I'm playing catch-up on this one and the whole NASPERS process kind of setup. So, Tom actually recently, it's only a couple of days old, he made this video about Guy Spier and how he's been buying Prosus shares. And in it, he explains the kind of Prosus thesis and why people are so interested, why value investors are so interested in it. So, definitely check out that video because I'm basically ripping this information out of that video. So, thank you, Tom. Appreciate it. more likely he's buying Prosus. Prosus is essentially a spin-off of the South African company NASPERS. So, the story is that NASPERS, like 2 decades ago, like 20-something years ago, they bought a $30 million stake in Tencent. And at that time, they bought like almost half of Tencent. Which wow. is pretty bonkers. And then the story is, like, over time, they've just basically never sold. Like, I think they've done a little bit of selling, but for the most part, they've just held basically most of that position. Now this, like, little South African, I think it was like a newspaper publishing company or something like that, is just like this behemoth. And I think Tom shows a statistic of how much of that whole, I think it's on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange or something like right. that. And it takes up like 25% of that whole market, which is pretty insane. And it's just because their Tencent stake has just grown to some enormous stake over time.
Yeah.
So these value investors are looking at this company, which is now Prosus, and they're thinking that this is an alternate way of essentially holding Tencent stock. And the reason they're so interested in it is because buying Prosus shares is actually a way you get an amazing discount to buying Tencent shares. So Tom showed this chart of where the net asset value per share of Prosus is 123 euros. And the stock price, I checked it this morning, is 77 euros. And Whoa. This company is like just stacked full of Tencent. So there's kind of like, instead of just owning Tencent stock and just getting the upside of owning Tencent, in this instance, you get the upside of owning Tencent, but you also get the upside of the stock or of the market cap normalizing to the net asset value.
Right.
And there's still a massive discount at the current time of their net asset value per share versus their stock price, 123 euro versus 77 euro.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So you do get, a discount on Tencent and then you'd have to do an assessment, I guess, of the rest of it. So is Prosus, does that have other businesses in it?
I'm not 100% sure and I need to go in depth because Tom was saying in that video that they made Prosus specifically to try and like help people realize that it's really Tencent, but I don't know what else you get as a part of Prosus.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
Maybe we should get like Tom on to explain it.
Yeah, we should
do a much better job.
We should. Yeah. Because it is a really interesting case. And I guess of course you'd probably have to weigh inflation and other market risks of investing on a different exchange. What is it? A South African exchange? Is that one listed? So yeah, it would be interesting to kind of take a look at that. But it's yeah, it sounds like something that's kind of right up Monish Pabrai's alley. I mean, I think he made a big investment relatively recently in a Turkish company, and Turkey has crazy inflation, but the business was so undervalued that even considering, you know, massive amounts of inflation, it was still a really good deal. So this kind of deal in that respect, I think, is well up Monish's alley. But I guess we'll never know, right? unless he tells us whether whether he's made that investment. I wish everywhere had to do some kind of reporting. That would be
I think there's obviously some places where it's like if you own more than 5% you have to report it. Right. There's like some shareholder reports. Actually ticker.com is a really good website that tries to scrape not only 13F filings but all kind of resources like shareholder reports and ownership filings and that sort of thing to give a more complete sense of their global portfolio. Because if you just looked at Monish Pabrai's 13F, you think he holds three stocks. There's only three stocks that he holds in his 13F.
Yeah,
It's Micron, Seritage, and Barber. But
he has others.
But he has way. Yeah, he has heaps more. So I thought that was interesting. So obviously, this video is talking. Tom's video is talking about how Guy Spier was buying Prosus shares, and I just think it's Monish Pabrai doing the same thing because we know that Guy Spier and Monish Pabrai are basically joined at the hip when it comes to their investments. So that's kind of my rationale. So I think that's quite interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. I wonder, Monish is usually quite, he usually holds his cards quite close to his chest while he's making moves. So it is interesting that he spoke quite a lot about Tesla. I mean, about Tesla, about Tencent in that Q&A that he did. So I don't know whether we'll hear something from him about this. I don't know. Might be a year or more before we know for sure, but maybe not. I don't know. We'll just have to see, I guess.
Yeah. So there we go. That's Monish Pabrai's Q3 13F filing. Very, very interesting. We'll have to see.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure he's buying Tencent. I'm reasonably sure.
I just called Tencent Tesla, and that's kind of related to I'm going to use that as a segue to talk about Michael Burry. And his 13F. There's not too much. I mean, he made a lot of moves, a lot of selling moves as well, but there's not. He does, right? He has a portfolio that's usually stacked with put options and call options. So he has a lot of contracts that kind of expire, or he sells them and then usually he writes new or buys new contracts. So there's usually quite a lot of movement, particularly around the options part of his portfolio. And that was no exception in this quarter. He had 22 positions at the start of the quarter, if you include his option positions. He sold or got rid of 100% of 19 of those during the quarter. He then added three new ones. And so, of course, he has six positions left. So, he basically cut down a lot of the positions that he had, but most of those were options contracts. But within those options contracts were some very interesting things that we were kind of watching. So, I think the biggest move was he sold Tesla put options. So these were bets against Tesla that I think he'd had these for a while, right? I think he'd had them for a couple of quarters. Yeah. And I mean, Burry's been very, he's been very pessimistic on Tesla for a long time, around its valuation at least. So, you know, it was no surprise to see him have those put options, but he got rid of them. He had 1 million put options against Tesla, which is kind of crazy.
Wow.
He got rid of them. And it's always good to kind of take a look at what the stock did during that period, especially when it comes to something like a put option, which, you know, a stock has to go down in order for that to generate a return. And Tesla stock was up 15% during the quarter. So, not very good for Burry. Although, assuming that he didn't add any more put options in the fourth quarter, which we can't see yet, Tesla stock in the last month is up 25%. So, hopefully he dodged that.
I think he did, yeah.
Well, I mean, we don't really know, right? Because he could have, right at the end of the quarter, initiated some more options that we won't see until I don't know.
The reason that I say that is because I think I can't remember how long ago it was, but it was probably at least a month ago. Did I make a video about it? Let me just check the date of this video because that will give me. But he essentially came out and he said, yeah, I'm out. I'm not shorting Tesla anymore.
Right.
That was, I made the video on October the 24th.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would highly doubt it. You're right that we don't know, but he's come out to the media and said, look, no, I'm not shorting Tesla anymore.
Yeah.
So,
I mean,
yeah, but if that's true, then thank goodness for him because he has sidestepped some definite losses.
Yeah, for sure.
In the past month or so.
Yeah. And I think that whole thing kind of just speaks to the risk of one, running put options contracts, which are based on, you know, short-term movements, but then also based on the risks of shorting. I mean, I personally think that Tesla is a little bit frothy for what the business...
just a tad
frothy from what the business is producing right now. But I mean, markets can stay irrational for a really long time. And I mean, in all seriousness, Tesla could just stay, you know, in overvalued territory for a very long time while the business improves. So, you know, that's also a possibility. It's not necessarily the case that, you know, its stock price has to collapse down to what the business is producing today and then rise with that for the next 10 or 15 years. So I think that's obviously the risk with running short-term bets and bets against stocks that are maybe overvalued. So, yeah, disappointing to see that because I like Michael Burry and I honestly think he's right when it comes to Tesla. But
I think his thesis is right, yeah, but I just don't think that I would ever have the balls to bet like he does, to be honest.
No way.
we're too much of that Buffett kind of first rule of investing, don't lose money kind of mindset that things like, you know, options and... I guess options aren't too bad. You can control yourself with options. The most that you can lose is 100%. But things like short selling itself is something that just kind of scares me, to be honest.
Yeah. Terrifying. And yeah, I mean, Burry made a lot of other moves in relation to options. So he sold or got rid of his Facebook call options. So these were bets that Facebook would rise in the short term. Google call options as well. He got rid of those. He had put options, bets against the 20-year Treasury bond index. So, you know, betting that Treasury bonds would go down, that interest rates would rise, and a few others. So, all of those little bets, which if you look at how many shares they represented a large portion the vast majority of his portfolio, but on a dollar amount, I guess, on terms of how much he put in on those bets, it was a relatively small amount of his actual investment portfolio. So, all of those are gone. In terms of new stocks, there was three new stocks that he added to the portfolio. These are not options. These are just ownership, straight ownership in businesses. The biggest was Lockheed Martin, which is an aerospace business, which now represents 25% of his portfolio. So, pretty big bet on that business. I'll throw my hands up and say I know nothing about that business. So, I don't know. They have a lot of government contracts, I think.
I think it's just defense contracts, aerospace stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. They
probably stuff that's pretty secure and not really going to go away.
Yeah. You would imagine so. He made an investment in Distribution Now, which represents 3% of his portfolio. That's an energy company, another kind of stable one that's probably, you know, leans on the inflation defensive kind of play. Whereby, you know, things that people have to spend money on don't really kind of change their behavior around regardless of the price of it. So that kind of sits into that space. And then
they want to try and entice investors with that name. Distribution Now. Just a big fat energy company that just pays constant distribution or dividends. You want a Distribution Now? Invest with us.
We buy back.
WeBuyBack.com. That'd be so funny. BigFatDividend.com.
Oh boy. Dear. And then the other new stock he added, which was just 2% of his portfolio, so pretty small, was Cy Nexus, I think.
Good luck.
It's a pharmaceutical company. So, I mean, honestly, three businesses that I have no interest in and that are all probably in areas that I don't really understand at all. So
yeah,
I can't really comment on those personally.
Yep.
And then
I think I'm with you there.
And then his other holdings, so CVS, which he did not change during the period, is still the largest position, which is 41% of his portfolio. Geo right. Group is now 21% of the portfolio. And then Core Civics is a private prisons management business, I think, is 9% of his portfolio. So,
right.
Yeah, I'm not interested really in any of those businesses or any of those areas, no. to be honest.
And I think Burry also has quite a sizable cash position as well.
Yeah.
But I don't know that for sure. I just remember hearing that on listening to Phil Towns' podcast. He was saying that that Michael Burry's got a lot of cash on the sidelines apparently as well.
Yeah, well, that wouldn't surprise me at all given his position on inflation and the current state of the market. So, that's unfortunately something we don't get to see, I don't believe. So
yeah, I don't think so. Yeah.
But the only last thing I wanted to talk about with Michael Burry was, of course, so he got rid of his Tesla, his bet against Tesla. Musk came out and called Burry a broken record, which is
of course he did,
which is kind of poking the bear there. And Burry turned around and deleted his Twitter again. So Burry's gone. Again, we'll probably see him, I guess, in a month or two. He'll be back.
We'll see him in a week. Yeah.
He's probably back by the time this is out.
Yeah.
So he's gone again for now. So we'll see what happens with that. But that's not the first time he's disappeared off the Twitter realm. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Good old Michael Burry. He's a funny one.
Yeah.
He's got some whack views though, has to be said. He's got some crazy views.
Yeah, he's a bit of an enigma or something.
Yeah. He's loose. That guy. He's a good investor though, and he gets things right quite a lot.
yeah. Yes, he does.
All right. Should we fly through Warren Buffett?
Yeah, take us through.
That sounds strange saying that, doesn't it?
Yeah. Let's
fly through Warren Buffett's 13F. Unfortunately, there's just not a lot to talk about with Warren Buffett this quarter, which kind of makes perfect sense in the grand scheme of things. But yeah, still a bit boring. I'd still prefer him to have done something crazy so we can get some cool headlines and delve into it a little bit more. So for Warren Buffett, for Berkshire Hathaway, cash and US treasuries, so it's effectively like their short-term kind of cash position, up to $149 billion in Q3. It's a big stack of cash, isn't it? it kind of just shows like this cash pile's been growing and growing. It just shows you he's really struggling to find investments right now. And that's kind of the theme of this 13F and kind of the moves that he's been pulling over the last little while. So in terms of his portfolio, in terms of top 10 stocks, there's only one change, one piece of activity in his top 10 holdings, which was a 2% reduction in US Bancorp. So, you know, the large positions in his portfolio are pretty much set. He's not interested in changing them. Like, he didn't touch Apple or Bank of America, Coca-Cola, American Express, none of those stocks. They just all stayed as they were. He didn't add anything else into kind of like the top 10 or 15 stocks. So he hasn't found anything that he wanted to buy into. So let's have a look here. Pretty much I've just written here. The rest of the changes were kind of further down the list. It's a 43 position long list, and all the other changes were kind of in the smaller positions. So in terms of the stocks that he sold out of Merck and Organon and Liberty Global. Liberty Global is a European telco, I just learned today. Merck and Organon is a spin out of Merck. So Merck shareholders got Organon stock. So that's how Buffett got his stock there. But Merck is just a pharmaceutical company. So he sold out of that. And the Merck and Organon sales were consistent with the rest of his portfolio because he also reduced 16% in Bristol Myers Squibb and 29% in AbbVie, two other pharmaceutical companies. Okay. On top of that, he shaved 4% off of Visa, 6% off of MasterCard, two big moat companies. Reduced 19% in Charter Communications, which is the telecommunications company that owns Spectrum in the US. It's kind of broadband and cable. And then finally, you reduce 34% of Marsh & McLennan, which is an insurance and financial services company.
Right.
So, not really too much going on in terms of the big names.
Yeah.
There were only two very small kind of new positions in the quarter. Well, I say small, small for Buffett. He's still sunk many hundreds of millions of dollars into the-
It's funny that.
Yeah. So, he sunk $475 million into a pharmaceutical company called Royalty Pharma. That occupies 0.16% of their portfolio. It's crazy, that's, those stats, yeah, isn't
that
it?
That is a crazy stat. I mean, he's making hundreds of millions of dollars worth of moves and he's moving around like stock positions that are less than 1%.
Yeah.
This is crazy.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's honestly crazy. So, $475 million into Royalty Pharma and then $98 million into Floor and Decor Holdings.
Mm.
Any guesses as to what Floor and Decor Holdings sell?
maybe they're a flooring company. Maybe
they are a floor. They sell flooring products and decor products.
Yeah, I actually looked into them not too long ago. Interesting business. Yeah, yeah. They're like a specialty hardware store specializing in flooring.
So flooring and decor.
There you go.
Tiles, wood, laminate. You want it? You got it. but that's a very small position. 0.03% of the portfolio.
Yeah.
So, not too much to talk about there. And I've just written alongside the new buyers. So, Buffett added 24% to Chevron, which is now his 13th largest position, sits at 1% of the portfolio.
Hmm.
So, overall, it's a pretty boring kind of quarter, I would say. Nothing that's really changing, making headlines or changing opinions on this or that.
No.
Interestingly, he did one thing that was kind of newsworthy is that he did do, he sunk $7.6 billion into buybacks this quarter. By far his largest. So that's easily his largest investment for the quarter. I wrote here for reference, his total investment in Chevron is worth $3 billion.
Right. Wow. Yeah. So yeah, sizable investment back into their own stock.
Yeah. Exactly. And I actually looked, if just this buyback was an investment in his portfolio, it would be his eighth largest position in his portfolio.
Yeah. Well, I think there was a study that was recently done that showed the comparison of how much money had been spent on buybacks relative to what that did to stock prices. And it was crazy. It was like for every dollar that went in for buybacks, like the stock market went up like $10 or something like that, or $8. So
really?
There must be some, I mean, there's something to it that, you know, you get good value, at least at the moment, for buying back your own stock. I mean, look, I mean, we're seeing every company do it. We're seeing companies take on debt and buying back stock. So
yeah.
I think there's a combination of course, it increases the value of each share just by the nature of, well, as long as the business continues to grow, you're getting a high percentage ownership. But there's also, I guess, the psychological component that, you know, people expect that the stock price will rise, that there's more buyers in the market, that the business will be on the share price will be more valuable, each share will be more valuable. So I mean, it's paid for businesses to do buybacks over the past few years. So makes sense.
Yeah. Buffett's bought $20.2 billion worth of Berkshire stock this year. It's quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah. That is crazy. Yeah. And I mean, he's made no move. So it is kind of boring, but it's also the Buffett we love, right? It's the guy that we know doesn't make investments very often, and that it's a set and forget portfolio that, you know, for the most part, he's comfortable with the big investments that he's made, some of them that he made decades ago and that he hasn't touched. Yeah. American Express, Coca-Cola, and these kinds of things. And even Apple now, I mean, he's trimmed it here and there over the past couple of years, but the position is huge and it really hasn't changed all that much since, 2015, 2016? So even that one's getting quite old now. So that's the that's the Buffett we like, I think. Just the big investment occasionally and otherwise set and forget.
Yeah. Yeah, interestingly, his buybacks this year, $20.2 billion, is the same as the market value of his total Coca-Cola position, which is his fourth largest position. So, that really does put things in perspective that Buffett's really hooking into Berkshire Hathaway stock.
Yeah, yeah.
It's pretty crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that's pretty much all I had for Warren Buffett.
Mm.
Yeah, I think what you say is right though. I mean, you'd kind of ask questions if you just saw massive changes in his top 10 holdings like every single quarter.
Yeah.
You'd be like, Buffett, you're not really living like what you say. Yeah. But yeah, no, interesting. Yeah. So, all right, shall we move on to do a couple Q&A before we wrap up?
Absolutely, yeah. Shall I read this one to you? Do you want this one?
Sure. Yep, go ahead.
All right. When dealing with cyclical businesses, how do you feel about trying to avoid their negative business cycle and the implicit tumble of the stock price? Of course, I know this is precisely when the negative cycle and or the tumble happens that will buy the stock, supported by our future cash flow projections or predictions. Despite the theory about predicting the intrinsic value of a business, I remember that Peter Lynch, for example, said that when dealing with cyclicals, he would always keep an eye out for, particularly on the inventory being a red flag signaling possibly a sell when it grew at a faster rate than sales.
Yeah, I think that makes sense what Peter Lynch is talking about, because if inventory is building up and sales are slowing down, then that could be an indicator that that business is kind of at the end of its kind of great run. If inventory is just piling up around the place and they can't really shift it, then you're like, okay. But I think my thoughts on that as an indicator would probably be that, you know, sometimes you'd absolutely hit the nail on the head and that would be the end of its run. But I think it would be hit and miss. So I think sometimes it would be almost give you like a false positive where you'd be like, oh, they're at the end of the run. But in actual fact, it was something else, maybe logistics or something like that. I know when I'm looking at like even just like Tesla, their inventory and their demand and the amount of cars they produce and deliver, like model, they've got like record demand for all their vehicles. And then for a little while there, the Model S and X, they delivered zero of those cars. And of course that was because they were retooling the lines and stuff. But I think when you start looking at that, it's a good kind of indicator, but if you just trusted it, I think you'd get caught out a lot. You'd kind of sell businesses when they weren't at the top. Maybe I'm wrong there, but I don't know. But honestly, I don't really get too much into cyclicals because I mean, ideally, I don't want to buy a company that has good and bad periods. I want to buy a company that can continually, consistently just keep up in its numbers, keep growing over time. So I like more of the growing moat companies. So even in the, you know, sure, every company, like every market has its bad times, every company has its bad times, but I kind of like the big moat companies where even if you're in a recession or something, they can still perform very well relative to other companies because they're holding onto that massive moat.
Yeah.
So I tend to look more at those kind of companies than companies that fall into big cyclical cycle, big cycles, I guess, cyclical cycles. That's an interesting concept, isn't it? But yeah, I don't know if you have any more insights into cyclical businesses.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely avoid cyclicals that, and this is a lot of cyclicals that go from profitability to being unprofitable during the negative cycle, just because those businesses are so unpredictable. I mean, lot of them go bankrupt very, very easily because they maybe take on a ton of debt to make up for the fact that they're coming out of a really tough period. They might have a boom, but then they have a ton of debt and they're losing money, and it can be really touch and go for a lot of businesses. So I avoid those businesses. My experience with cyclicals really is on Thor Industries, which is in a very cyclical industry, the RV industry, but it is a business that, I think it's the only business that has consistently remained profitable through 3, 4, 5 different recessions. So they're a unique business in that industry where they profits and revenues drop a lot during a recession, but they're kind of protected on the very bottom by remaining profitable and keeping debt to a low level or even zero in most cases. But my experience, I mean, I'm not sure about Peter Lynch's indicators or anything like that, but my experience is the price has always led even the slightest expectation that the cycle is over. So before any data is indicating that sales are slowing down and that inventory is building up, before any of that has even happened, from just watching Thor Industries, which has gone through a couple of cycles, the price has always led expectations. So I've never had, you know, any thoughts about trying to predict when to sell and get out before it dips down. But on the low side, it's you know, the same as buying anything, I think. I mean, if you can come up with a reasonable projection of intrinsic value, then when the stock is down, you don't really need to know it's the bottom of the cycle. You just need to be buying it at an appropriate price. Cyclicals, it's a lot more difficult, I think, because their earnings fluctuate. So you've got to be very careful with what cash flows you're projecting. You've got to project, you know, an average between the highs and the lows, right? It's a lot more difficult than consistent businesses, but it can be done. And you've just got to be willing to weather a volatile stock price, because it will be volatile. But
yeah, true.
Yeah, true. That's kind of my thoughts on that.
All right. Should I ask you this one here?
Yeah, sure.
And then maybe we'll do one more and then wrap it up.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Hi, guys. Great podcast. Thank you very much. Quick question. With inflation not being transitory, what do you think on investing in treasury inflation-protected securities or tips instead of just keeping the cash? Does it make sense to keep money on those securities and selling when you find a good asset to actually allocate your money into in the long term?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I'll admit, I don't really know too much about these kinds of things, but there's a couple of reasons why they're kind of usually not preferable even to normal bonds, which I think personally right now, I'm not interested in either of them because they're just offering such terrible real returns. But I mean, there's a couple of reasons why TIPS are a little bit worse than, or can be worse than regular bonds. So one is that when they say inflation protected, they're protected based on CPI data, which could be, you know, not an actual representation of real inflation. So real inflation could be higher. The CPI data is lower, therefore it doesn't actually protect you from inflation. So that's kind of one thing. The other is that normal bonds, not inflation protected, pretty much price inflation in any way, because investors buy and sell bonds based on inflation expectations. So normal bonds, you know, move to reflect inflation anyway.
Right.
And normal bonds actually, because, you know, investors are emotional people, inflation expectations are usually higher than what inflation really is over a long period of performance tracking. So the result of that actually is that normal bonds tend to provide more inflation protection over long periods than TIPS do, because investors trade bonds based on inflation expectations and expect worse inflation than actually occurs. So that's kind of a second reason. And then the third is that they still fluctuate based on investor confidence and interest rates, right? So they really don't provide an alternative to cash, an inflation-protected alternative to cash, as they might seem that they would. I mean, in 2020, for example, there was a big deflation and the TIPS absolutely collapsed. So you could not have used them to buy stocks like you could have with cash. So that's just a couple of things to keep in mind. But bonds is not an area I'm overly familiar with. So, I mean, I'm a very much a...
Jeez, you sound like you know a lot about it. You know a lot more than I do. I know nothing about this sort of stuff.
I mean, I know a little bit, but I mean, I'm very, very comfortable, especially when interest rates are this low and inflation is this high. Bonds really offer you nothing, because
that's true.
If there's a period of uncertainty, bonds are not going to go up. There's nowhere for them to go up. They're already at basically peak, because interest rates are at bottom, and that's the same as saying bonds are at peak. So they only have one place to go, and that's down, even in a period of uncertainty, especially in a period of uncertainty. So they don't give you the inverse relationship that they used to, where you could hold stocks and bonds, and if stocks go down, bonds go up. That just doesn't occur when interest rates are this low. That relationship is broken. So I prefer to just hold cash.
Yeah. I my mind goes back to the Berkshire shareholder meeting where Buffett pulled that little newspaper clip out of his pocket, and how he just went on that rant about how when they filmed that meeting, it was just like the short-term bonds literally gave you no return. Like, you were putting down money and getting nothing, like no extra money back, which is just bonkers.
Yeah, bonds are like, they're not great. They're better when interest rates are higher and you get that inverse relationship between stocks and bonds, where people flood to bonds in uncertainty. That is not happening right now. It can't happen.
Yeah.
Bonds are at the highest they can basically be unless they go negative.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And there are some bonds that are going negative around the world.
But yeah, there are. There are. And they certainly...
Blows my mind.
Yeah.
Doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't really make any sense. I mean, they're certainly negative right now on real terms if you consider inflation. So,
yeah, true.
I mean, true. Yeah.
True. All right. That'll just about do us. What a show. That was a lot. We got through a lot today.
Yeah, jam-packed.
Yeah, it's always a big time. 13F's come out. We want to talk about all of them. So hopefully you guys enjoyed the episode. Thanks very much for listening. As always, we appreciate the hour and 5 minutes that you've given us this week to listen to us ramble about great investors for for an hour or so. But yeah, make sure you keep the questions coming as well. We're slowly getting through now our long list. We ticked a few more off today. So if you wanted to leave a question for the podcast, then just go over to the YouTube version of the podcast, head down to the comments and just leave a comment on the most recent podcast. And then we just each week before we do the podcast, we just grab them, chuck them in the Google Doc, and it kind of adds on to the end of the list and we just kind of work through them. But yeah, apart from that, guys, thank you very much for listening. Thanks, Hamish, as always, for joining me and having a chat. Thanks very much to ShareSite for sponsoring this episode, and we'll see you guys next week.
See you guys.